That was Lena Horne as recorded in 1944. This is Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 4 minutes to 4 o'clock. And with me is Gail Lumet Buckley, who writes that as the daughter of a celebrity, Lena Horne, and for many years the wife of a celebrity, film director Sidney Lumet, she spent most of her life isolated from blacks, whites, and the mainstream. She says it took her a long time to recognize her blackness or her Americanness, and that writing her new book gave her the gifts of both. Gail Lumet Buckley's new book, The Hornes, An American Family, traces her family history. She begins with matriarch Sinai Reynolds, a house slave in the South, who bought her own freedom. She follows the Horne family in the North, where they were part of the black middle class of Harlem and Brooklyn. Lena Horne's grandmother was a friend of Paul Robeson's and helped fund his college education. She was a childhood friend of W.E.B. Du Bois. Lena Horne's uncle, Frank was a poet, doctor, and member of FDR's so-called black cabinet. Her parents broke the intellectual and social traditions of the family. Lena Horne's father got into numbers running and gambling. Her mother wanted a stage career. They divorced when Lena was very young. Lena Horne became Hollywood's first glamorous black star, but between racial discrimination and blacklisting, she was given few roles. My guest, Gail Buckley, grew up in New York, Los Angeles, and Europe, and graduated from Harvard. She worked at Life magazine before raising her family. Her new book, The Hornes, An American Family, is published by Knopf. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Why did you want to write about your family?
Well, it was the material that said write about me, or write about it, or however material speaks to you. But I had this trunk of family papers that had been my grandfather's trunk, which actually was every single, contained all the sort of the life of this family. It was amazing through six generations. Every sporting event that my grandfather ever attended, but more important than that, all the papers of my great-grandfather, who had been in politics and journalism in the 1870s and 1880s. And there was these wonderful newspapers where he'd written about the Civil Rights Act of 1875. There was a letter from Benjamin Harrison, president of the United States, not very exciting president, but president nonetheless, personal letter. Diaries, photographs, family memorabilia that was just, it seemed to me, this is an aspect of black life that has rarely, if ever, been portrayed. This sort of story of quiet achievement and of people who were in the mainstream fighting the battles quietly that eventually, 100 years later, would lead to the civil rights revolution of the 1960s.
The Horne family was a pretty prosperous family.
Yes, as black families go, yes.
I'm reminded, a poet once said to me that most black people are expected to tell stories of what it was like growing up poor, and white people always want to hear that from them. And I wonder if you think that's true, and if you think in the process that the black middle class has really been overlooked or not understood.
I think that's a very astute point. I think that's why nobody's really cared about the black middle class, because they weren't headline makers. They were people who lived perhaps as your family might have lived, quietly going about their business. They had certain values and ethics which they firmly believed in, getting an education, rather puritanical, firmly believing in the Judeo-Christian ethics, Protestant morality, all the things that theoretically make for middle-class life in America.
You said that writing this book made you feel more black and more American.
Yes.
Also, what was it about doing this that had that effect on you?
It was history. My editor, who's a wonderful man called Bob Gottlieb, said, read for a year before you even start to write. So I immersed myself in American history and in black history and found out the most amazing things and became a history buff and felt I wanted to put these people into historical perspective, which I hope I've done. This was the main thrust of in a way, of the story, that I felt this is, they're perhaps an historical footnote, but it's a footnote I'd like to be read.
You refer to the black bourgeoisie and use that term more than the black middle class.
Yes.
Let me ask you about the choice of that expression.
Yes. Well, it comes from E. Franklin Frazier's book for the same name, The Black Bourgeoisie. And the people I'm writing about were the black bourgeoisie that he was writing about. The black middle class is something else entirely. I mean, what I consider the black middle class, which is something born in the 1960s. Before the 1960s, America was an apartheid country, essentially. And the black bourgeoisie was the sort of small brown mass within the great black mass, within the great white world, this great segregated world. And they were sort of the buffer zone. I called them the ambassadors to either race. Often the ambassadors of perhaps whiteness in black America than blackness in white America. But this was the role they saw themselves as having. And they were the people who would get the jobs when jobs were to be had, the plum jobs, I mean. They were the 1%, when you read statistics, say, in 1900, who were in business, who were professional, black professionals. They were lawyers, they were teachers, they were doctors, they were educated clergy. They didn't make a lot of money. The economic avenues open to the black middle class today did not exist before the 1960s. They did not exist for the people I'm writing about. There were few black entrepreneurs, for example.
How did the Horn family become a member of this more prosperous class?
Well, I think it started right after the Civil War. They were fortunate in their slavery, if you could call slaves fortunate. They were house slaves. They lived in Atlanta rather than in the country. My great-great-great-great-grandmother bought her freedom in 1859 for herself and for some of her children, not for all of them. My great-great-great-grandmother remained a slave. She was a household cook in the family of Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun in Atlanta, Georgia. He was the nephew of John C. Calhoun, slavery's greatest apologist. And when he died after the war, he left money to my great-grandmother's, my great-great-great-grandmother's daughter, and who was living with my great-great-grandfather, her brother. And they had money. They were literate. They could read and write. Their mother could read and write. So after the war, my great-great-grandfather bought a grocery store, bought property, sent his two daughters to college, was able to be, this is a man who spent half his life in slavery, but he was able, with emancipation and with radical reconstruction, this is the key, that radical reconstruction was the best thing that has ever happened to black people in America until the 1960s. And even then it was somewhat more extraordinary, perhaps, because the laws of radical reconstruction changed the South not only for the blacks, but for the poor whites as well. It's an incredible time in the South. So 10 years was all it lasted.
I think one of the traits that characterizes some of the members of the black bourgeoisie, as you describe it in Brooklyn and New York, was that they were lighter than a lot of other black people, many of the members of the black bourgeoisie. Do you think that there was a caste in that respect?
Well, this had been part of the white power structure. You see it in Caribbean societies. To divide the field slave and the house slave, there were often, I mean, the Old South was a feudal society, so the master taking a fancy to any slaves he wanted to was considered normal. And usually they would be the house slaves. They were the most handy, I suppose. In the Calhoun family, for household, for example, the slave children and legitimate children had the same names. So there'd be little black Catherines and little white Catherines running around, and Moses as well. This became one of the sort of badges of being in the black middle, the old black bourgeoisie. There was great snobbery about skin color because this, again, was meant to differentiate you from the field hand. In the 19th century, for example, every significant slave rebellion was betrayed by a house slave. The house slave was taught he had something to lose. The field hand had nothing to lose. This continued after the war when the slaves who either had been free before the war, for example, in the North or in a couple of southern towns, and the former house slaves and favored slaves who were artisans or coachmen, that sort of thing, came together and became the black bourgeoisie. Now, the black bourgeoisie was based on family background and education and skin color was incredibly important. And this was one of the things that the 1960s changed.
Was there intermarriage in your family before your mother?
No. No. As a matter of fact, my mother's, it was curious, though there were members of the family who passed for white, so probably they intermarried. But there's a character called Edwina, who was my mother's second cousin, her father's cousin, who was the daughter of Lena, for whom she was named, her grandmother's sister, who looked white, and she fell in love with a man with very dark skin, and her family absolutely forbade the relationship and said, "You cannot see this man. You cannot even consider marrying this man." That was the kind of world it was. There were a lot of wonderful things about the old black bourgeoisie, but that was not one of them. The snobbery.
Your grandparents seem to have been in the couple that violated the traditions of the Horn family.
Third generation black sheep is what they were. They said, to heck with all this uplift and being do-gooders, because my great-grandparents were definitely do-gooders.
Meaning what?
Activists. My great-grandfather, as I said, wrote about the Civil Rights Act of 1875, founded a lobbying group called the United Colored Democracy, which was made up of disaffected black Republicans. And he was one of the reasons that the black vote, for the first black Democratic vote in New York, and the first Democratic governor in a long time in New York State, he got the black vote to switch in 1910 from the Republicans to the Democrats. And he had been a Republican until he moved to New York and became a Democrat. My great-grandmother, on the other hand, remained Republican all her life, the party of Lincoln and Douglas. And she was a feminist. She was a suffragette. She was an early founding member of the NAACP and the National Council of Negro Women. And she was out working for unwed mothers and juvenile delinquents. And by the time my grandparents' generation, some of them continued. My great-uncle Frank, for example, who was in Roosevelt's black cabinet, was definitely a do-gooder. But by the third generation, and Fraser writes about this, it was much more. The black bourgeoisie had become about cocktail parties and bridge clubs more than it was about doing good for the rest of the race. Du Bois's talented 10th had become the partying 10th. And these were the partying members of the black bourgeoisie. They were definitely the black sheeps of their respective families. And they, both of them, though they married in 1916, they really were people who were going to sort of find themselves in the 20s. And the 20s were an extraordinary time for everybody. You know, that was when they were like the 60s in a way, except not politically, but socially. And to heck with old responsibilities. They both ran away from their child.
What did your grandparents do to earn the reputation of black sheep?
Well, my grandfather, theoretically, this is family history. We hope it's true. Or at least I hope it's true because it's fun. Made a killing on the Black Sox scandal of 1921, the baseball fix. He certainly suddenly had a lot of money in 1921 and ran off to Seattle that year. Ran away from his wife and his 3-year-old daughter, Lena, 4-year-old daughter, whatever she was. And was never to be heard of since, but to her, except through gifts and letters. And he was away out of her life for a long time. Shortly thereafter, her mother left her to go on the stage. And this was unheard of, because her mother had also been brought up in the bosom of the bourgeoisie and the stage. The only career that a black bourgeois woman could accept honorably was teaching. And that's when they did work, they taught, or social work. And to go on the stage was tantamount to prostitution.
So your mother ended up getting shuttled back and forth between relatives in the South and in the North.
Yes, she did. She was initially brought up by her grandmother in Brooklyn, the wonderful Cora Calhoun, feminist and suffragette. And then her mother decided, "I want this child back." And she didn't really want the child. She just wanted to make her mother-in-law mad, it turns out, because she would be touring in these tent shows in the South and would leave little Lena with whoever happened to be around while she'd go off. And so my mother created a sort of dual personality for herself, her Southern personality when she'd go to one-room schoolhouses and the kids made fun of her accent and her skin color, and then the other personality that she'd have to, which was her real personality when she'd go back to her grandmother and to Brooklyn and her friends in Brooklyn. Finally, there was a semblance of security when her Uncle Frank was dean of a college in Georgia and brought her and said, I'm taking you to live with me for a while. Took her to Georgia in 1928.
So in a way, she was really a perpetual outsider
as
a child.
Yes, she was. She was an outsider, both in the middle class in a way, even though those were her roots, and certainly with poorer blacks among whom she lived, but did not really belong.
My guest is Gail Lumet Buckley. She's written a family history, and it's called The Horns and American Family, and the most famous member of the family is her mother, Lena Horn. How did your mother start in show business?
Well, she'd done amateur theatrics in clubs, in her various little clubs in Brooklyn, the Junior Debs, they were called. And they would do, she wanted to sing and dance. Her mother, she'd always had dancing and singing lessons. And her idol was Florence Mills, a great black star of the 20s with a meteoric career, who died young. And she'd done amateur theatrics. And when her grandmother died, her mother decided, I'm going to put this girl on the stage. She's pretty and she's talented. Let's see what happens. So at 16, she was put into the Cotton Club.
It's interesting. Your father provided protection, so to
yes.
speak, for her when she was
yes.
playing in these clubs that were frequently run by the mob.
Yes, absolutely. Dutch Schultz's mob protected her in the Cotton Club because he was very close to Dutch Schultz's black numbers men.
At the Cotton Club, she was billed as a quadroon, was it?
Well, it wasn't at the Cotton Club. It was in a Broadway play that she did while she was at the Cotton Club called Voodoo something or other, and she was billed as a quadroon girl.
What was the point of that? Were people billed racially?
No,
like
this was
that?
Not a bill. This was a character.
Oh, I see.
This
I misunderstood
a character.
That.
Yeah, this
okay.
was a character in the... No, they weren't billed racially. This is a character in the play.
Well, you write that when she was 19, she had no boyfriends because her mother really wanted her to focus on the stage
yes,
and not to be distracted. What happened to her when she married young? What happened to her career?
Well, she assumed that she was going to retire. And then shortly after I was born, a call came from Hollywood, a quickie. All-black musical film was being produced in Hollywood, and some people who had seen her in the Cotton Club said, come and do this show, or this movie, without auditioning or anything. And she was not the same slim creature she'd been in the Cotton Club. She just had a baby, and she arrived, and they were sort of disappointed. But nevertheless, she made the movie, which I saw. It's kind of funny. It was called The Duke is Tops. Then when she became a star, they renamed it to Bronze Venus and made her the star. It was still the same movie. It was a sort of backstage romance, very innocuous story. And so that was sort of a dip into show business. Then she got another call after she finished that movie to be in a Blackbird show, Blackbirds of 1939, which was a flop. But when it opened on Broadway, it only lasted about 7 performances. She got wonderful reviews from the New York Times, and all the columnists noticed her.
She had just had a baby before returning. Were you the baby?
Before returning
to show business,
that was probably my brother. I was the first baby when she went made the movie. Then she actually had my brother after the Blackbirds of 1939 show.
Did you go with her backstage to any of the shows? Were you aware of the performances she was doing when you were very young?
No, well, not at that age. Not at that age. I never started going backstage till I was probably about 10. I remember seeing her in the movies when I was young, though.
What was that experience like?
Well, the first time I saw her in the movies was very scary. I saw A Cabin in the Sky, and she was in New York, and I was in California. And in the end of Cabin in the Sky, there's this big earthquake. And it looks as if she died. So I had to be taken in tears from the movie. And they had to call my mother in New York to let me know she was still in the land of the living.
How old were you?
I was probably 5.
So you really couldn't tell the difference between movies and reality then?
Then as a treat, I was taken to see Bambi so that I'd get over it. Then Bambi's mother died in the forest fire. It was a disaster. I couldn't go to movies.
Your mother spent some time touring with the Charlie Barnett Band, and they'd tour through the South.
Yes.
And run into all kinds of segregation problems. Did she ever consider trying to pass for white during that period?
She never did, though people earlier in her career and later in her career, all through her career in the early stages, people had suggested, and she always refused.
Since she was the granddaughter of people who had been very important in the black bourgeoisie in New York, did she feel that it was okay for her to be in show business or music? Did she feel like she was violating the family tradition in any way? Now, we'd spoken about how her father ended up being your grandfather ended up being a numbers runner and gambler, and your grandmother, her mother, wanted her to be on the stage. So for her parents, show business would have been fine.
Great. No, it was fine. But for her grandmother would have been horrified if she'd been alive. She wanted to be a teacher. She was going to be a teacher. That was all set. Even though she'd encourage the music lessons, because this was all right. Bourgeois children were exposed to culture, as it were.
Was she guilty about that?
I don't think so. I think she was very interested in her career. I think she was serious about it. She had to make money. And this was the middle of the Depression when she was starting all this. And I think she had ambition. She really wanted to make it.
After some of the performances that you mentioned, like the Lou Leslie's Blackbirds of 1939, she for a while sang at Cafe Society.
Yes, that was her favorite job she ever had, so she says.
Describe what was so special about the club.
Well, it was a special place. It was very much as, I called it a seminar with drinks. Barney Josephson was an old line socialist, pacifist, who wanted to start a nightclub. It was the first integrated nightclub in New York outside of Harlem, where both the patrons and a few jazz spots would allow black customers in. But the policy was integration. The policy was no fancy, no fake palm trees, no cigarette girls. It was all very left wing. Helen Lawrenson, in her book, I'm not sure which one it was, Whistling Girl or her first book, says that it was a Communist Party-backed idea. I don't know whether it was or not, but it was definitely left-wing. It was definitely very intellectually stimulating. And everybody important who was black went there, and everybody important who was white went there. So it was a fabulous meeting ground. And this is where my mother met friends of her uncles and friends of her parents. Not her parents particularly, but her grandparents, people who knew them, and especially of her uncle Frank, who were people who had become very important in her life, like Paul Robeson.
And a lot of intellectuals and writers hung out there.
Yeah.
So I guess.
And great performers. I mean, Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson, Comden and Green, Judy Holiday, Zero Mostel. All these Hazel Scott, all these people got their start at Cafe Society.
So it's one of the places in her life where her entertaining career and her family background came together.
Came together, absolutely. Probably the only place where it really came together so neatly. And she was very happy there, and she got wonderful reviews. And it was sort of, it was where her career really began, because it was from there that she was asked to come to Hollywood to open a new nightclub. And when she did that, that was the beginning of her Hollywood career.
I thought it was interesting the way Bonnie Josephson suggested changes in her repertoire when she was singing in Cafe Society.
Yes,
would you explain that?
Yes, and she auditioned for Barney. She first started singing Sleepy Time Down South, and he said, no, you can't sing that song. Don't you know what they do to black people in the South? So she said, oh, I'm sorry. And then she started singing a song called Down Argentina Way. He said, no, you can't sing that. There are all these girls in Brooklyn who were changing their name and pretending to be Latin. You've got to be yourself. You've got to be real. Who are you? And she said, gosh, I don't know. So Barney's a wonderful guy, maintains that he sort of taught her what to sing and how to sing it in a way.
And he suggested she just sing standards.
He said, sing standards and sing the blues, sing one blues. And she said, I can't sing the blues. She'd never sang the blues. The black bourgeoisie did not approve of the blues. And he said, nonsense. Sing Billie's blues, which is Billie Holiday's song. And she just was so nervous about it and felt she couldn't do it. So she went to talk to Billie Holiday, who said, do you have two children to take care of? Do you, you know, so you can see anybody, just sing it and don't worry about anything else. She was a wonderful woman, sad, wonderful woman.
Did you meet her?
I never met her. At least I don't think so. Maybe I did when I was a tiny child, but I don't remember. But she was very good to my mother.
So you must have grown up with a lot of music.
Yes, I did, with my stepfather and between my stepfather and my mother, I did. I grew up, music was incredibly important.
My guest is Gail Lumet Buckley, and she's written a new book called The Horns and American Family, which is a history of her family. When your mother, Lena Horne, signed her MGM contract, she was, as you describe her, the first glamorous black star in Hollywood. So, I mean, before
yes.
her, what could
well,
blacks
you
do
played domestics or you played jungle extras. She was also the first long-term contract ever given a black player in Hollywood. And she was Walter White and Paul Robeson's test case. She was a test case to the NAACP, which had decided they were going to change the image of Hollywood. It was World War II. Okay, let's, you know, we're supposed to be fighting for democracy. Let's do it at home. And this was part of this program. And she was it. She was the test case. And that made her the enemy of a lot of black actors in Hollywood who were very upset. And they said, you're trying to take work away from us. There'll be no more jungle movies. There'll be no more old plantation movies. What are you trying to do? And Paul Robeson said to her, these people aren't important. The people who matter are out there, the Pullman porters, those people. And they want to see a new image. And you've got to do it. She said, okay.
What did the suit say exactly?
The suit?
Yeah. Did they actually file suit?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. The NAACP probably, they were trying to break the unions also. So I'm not sure about the legal aspects of it, but I know it was a concerted effort by the NAACP, and they had Wendell Willkie on their side. Wendell Willkie, who'd written a wonderful book in 1940, where he said, how can we, forgot the title of the book, but the basis of it was, how can we talk about fighting for democracy when there's no democracy at home? And also then the Office of War Information, I think it was called, which was the propaganda side of the war effort, decided to get in on the act also and polish up the image. And this was all part, and Hollywood was going to be the way to do it.
So what did Paul Robeson want your mother to do?
Wanted her to refuse to play a domestic, to refuse to play any role that was demeaning to the blacks. And to stick by that and not be swayed from it.
Did she have any doubts about taking on this?
Well, she did. She did. And she went back to New York and kind of very upset. I mean, it had all been so fast.
It's quite a responsibility.
It's an incredible responsibility. And she'd been this sort of overnight huge success in the Hollywood nightclub. She'd auditioned for Louis B. Mayer, who'd said, yes, sign her up instantly. And, of course, the first role that they screen tested her for was for a maid. Part. So they were really kind of trying to get out of it. They weren't taking it very seriously. But Robeson and Walter White were taking it seriously, and she was taking it seriously. And her father, Teddy Horn the gambler, came out to Hollywood, flew out very dapper, and demanded an interview very politely with Louis B. Mayer and said, I can afford to hire a maid for my daughter. She doesn't need to play a maid. And they were bowled over by this. They'd never seen anything like Teddy Horn or heard anything like that from the a black man who was not political anyway.
Did they know about his affiliation
they
with gangsters?
They knew nothing about him except that he was incredibly, he wore handmade shoes and sulca ties, and he walked in and spoke very coolly and quietly and said he wasn't going to let his daughter do anything that was undignified. So they had this, the family coming at them from one end, and Paul Robeson and Walter White of the NAACP from the other end, and they were stuck with doing the right thing.
So did she get roles? Were there roles for her?
There were no roles. There were never roles. It did not go that far. There were some good roles for black actors, They made a few good movies. I think John Huston or somebody wonderful made, there was a movie made called The Black Soldier or The Black GI, a propaganda documentary. And there were some movies made at Warner Brothers with Humphrey Bogart, with which you have some black actors playing black GIs. And so there were more roles for men. And my mother always just had was sort of in a part because all her part scenes were cut out of the South. In the South, her scenes were cut out. So she had to be filmed separately. So she never had roles. She just had moments in movies.
Why don't you explain how that worked when they cut out parts that she was in,
yes,
in the South, like in Words and Music, which
yes,
was
they would cut
the
out
movie biography of Rodgers and
yes,
Hart.
Yes, they would cut out The Lady is a Tramp, which she sang in it. They would just snip it out, take scissors and snip, snip, when it got south of the Mason-Dixon line.
So she couldn't be in anything that furthered the plot.
No, she could never be in anything that furthered the plot or was crucial to, it was a crucial moment in the movie, never.
She must have been very frustrated.
She must have been.
Did she ever talk to you about that?
She only talked about it when she did her show, funnily enough. Finally. She compensated by making a very hugely successful nightclub career and a very successful career in Europe. And that was what she did because the movies, I mean, the movies until Sidney Poitier, even today you'll find there are very few good roles for black women. Maybe they're starting up again, but if you think about how long it's been since Lena Horne theoretically was going to break the barriers and what's happened since, you'll see. The men have always fared slightly better, not great, slightly better. There's Eddie Murphy. There's, but there are many more men if you think about it.
Well, I'm blanking out on her name, but the woman who started Ain't Misbehavin' and now is playing a maid on television on, was it Give Me a
Nell
Break?
Carter.
Nell Carter,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think those television shows are as stereotyped as anything in the 30s and 40s. For everybody, not just for blacks. I think they're demeaning to all ethnic groups and all grown-ups.
Did MGM want to keep your mother under contract since they weren't giving her the
well,
kind of
yeah,
roles
you know
that
why
she was
they did.
For?
Yeah, they did because she was very key to the Lowe's vaudeville key chains. They owned a lot of theaters. And she would play those theaters, the Capitol in New York, whatever they were, they don't exist anymore. So she was good for their image. We're not racist. We have Lena Horne. She was there, so they could never be accused of racism.
You know what I thought was interesting? One of the people who you said supported her in her attempt to not play maids,
right,
and not play demeaning roles, was Hattie McDaniel.
Yes, yes, the first black Oscar winner who won an Oscar for playing Mammy. She was an amazing woman. And when all these other black actors who had spent their lives playing retainers and jungle extras said, "You're ruining our career and who do you think you are?" She invited Mother to dinner at her house, which was beautiful, full of wonderful furniture and antiques and everything, and said, "Look, I'm nobody's fat black mammy. That's how I earn my living. And you just do what you have to do. And don't pay any attention to those people." She was a great woman.
Someone who she...
And a great actress. Hattie McDaniel.
Someone who your mother didn't get along with so well was Ethel Waters.
Ethel Waters, yeah. Ethel Waters was... it was because of her background. It was unfortunate. She was a victim of the class caste thing. She mistrusted and disliked middle class blacks. And that was her main reason. And she was jealous because she'd been a huge star on Broadway. Huge star. Stormy Weather had been her song in the Cotton Club. And who was this upstart? And my mother was prettier and younger, and it was the old story. They could have been two white actresses. But it was a very bad scene there.
And with
Bill, Waters.
With Bill Robinson, who she worked with.
Yes, he was another person who also mistrusted middle-class blacks. He just was not a nice man. He was an Uncle Tom. Though I like the real Uncle Tom, I'm always telling people, if you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, he was a hero.
She really got it from all sides.
She did. But I think the forerunners always do. Look at Paul, look at Jackie Robinson.
Why did she leave Hollywood? Did the contract run out?
I think she just sort of got fed up and wanted to get away. And also, she wanted to get married, and they couldn't marry in Hollywood. It was illegal for blacks and whites to marry in 1946. And she had a big fight with MGM in 1946 because they wanted her to be in a musical called, St. Louis Woman, which had a wonderful score by Harold Arlen. And she sort of really wanted to do it, and MGM was backing it. But once again, she listened to the NAACP and Walter White, who said, don't do it, it's a demeaning role, which I think in this case was a mistake.
Why?
Well, because it was a great score. It was, she would have played a prostitute. I mean, you know, so what? It was on the stage. And it was, you know, it was, I think it would have been a great career opportunity for her to have been earlier on Broadway than she was.
Did she feel as strongly about the politics of the roles as the people who were advising her did?
I think she felt so strongly about, I think her respect for them was probably as great as her feelings. I think she was very torn in the St. Louis Woman incident. But I think she probably, she was very politicized, and Paul was very much a mentor, and Walter White. So I think she probably felt nearly as strongly.
I guess that's another part of her life that connects with the black bourgeoisie that you write about in the other parts of her family, like her grandparents, didn't her grandmother help put Paul Robeson
yes,
to school?
Yes, got him a scholarship to Rutgers. And he really respected her.
My guest is Gail Lumet Buckley, and she's written a family history called The Horns, an American Family. Did all of this seem glamorous to you?
Reading about it, you mean, or
no,
discovering
being
it?
There when you were young, and your mother was she's in the movies and
yeah,
nightclubs.
A lot of it did. A lot of it seemed glamorous when I was a kid. It really did. Meeting some of the stars, it did. I got a kick out of it.
Now you grew up more on the West Coast than on the East Coast.
Well,
right?
Early years in the West Coast, later years in the East Coast and in Europe.
Was there any like Hollywood or Los Angeles equivalent of the? You know, black aristocracy that
yes, there was definitely
your
Los Angeles
were part
equivalent.
Of?
Definitely. And we were intermittently a part of it. We were mostly a part of the Hollywood world more.
How did that, the black bourgeoisie or black aristocracy, whatever word you want to use, compare on the West Coast with what you knew of
it
your
was
grandparents
the same.
And
it was the same
their circles
thing
on the
palm
East Coast?
Tree. It was about clubs and about who your family knew and who your family were, and
society oriented.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
Was there much of a caste system based on race among actors and actresses? I'm not talking about the studios who cast you into roles, but like when you were growing up, did it matter in your school that you were black? Did the white students discriminate against blacks, or did, you know?
Well, in this school I went to in Hollywood, I was the only black. My brother and I were the only black children, and I tell a story in my book about one day at nap time, a little girl said to me, "Why is your arm so brown?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. Is it my arm? Yes, my arm is brown." At a young age, you're not aware of that sort of thing unless you get racial epithets hurled at you, and I never went to this sort of school where people would hurl racial epithets. So I was pretty much protected from that sort of thing.
Did your mother also try to protect you?
Definitely. When the teacher in my brother's class read Little Black Sambo to the class, my mother went down and raised hell in the school. How dare you? This was 1943 or something, reading Little Black Sambo.
So did you feel a little alienated when you were young, being, for instance, the only black person in your class?
No, because I didn't know what it meant to be alienated. I didn't feel that. I didn't know I was alienated. I think children sort of accept what their lives are. And I probably didn't realize that. I realized in retrospect that I would be the only black child at the birthday party. But then I was not. I was just aware that I was at the birthday party and having fun, you know.
Was there a different kind of caste system depending on how high your parents were in the celebrity system?
Yes, Hollywood. The Hollywood social world was divided into salaries. The people who made a certain amount of income all stuck together. The big stars, the people who made whatever. I mean, even in those days, nobody in Hollywood made the kind of money they make now. People did not get $1 million a picture. Clark Gable had a contract that probably paid him $1,000 a week. I mean, they were all, that was the old plantation system in Hollywood. They were very smart. But the $1,000 a week players did not socialize with the $250 a week player, that sort of thing. And with my mother and with me, it was subdivided further. Our friends were the liberal group, who were sort of transplanted New Yorkers, who were not racists, and the refugee colony, which were people from Europe who had fled from Hitler, and they were the sort of very talented Europeans who made movies in Europe and now are in Hollywood working on writers or directors, that sort of thing.
When your mother married Lenny Hayton, he white, she black. It was illegal.
Yes.
At the time. Did they explain that to you?
They didn't say it was illegal. They said they were getting married and it was a secret. That was all they said to me.
Would they tell you why you couldn't tell anybody?
No, they just said, don't tell anybody. And then, I was about 10 years old, so by 3 years later, when it was no longer a secret, I totally understood why.
Did that mean that you were moving more into the white world once that marriage
happened? Yes, it did. We were in the, what did you call it, the celebrity class by then. We were out of the black world. We were out of the ordinary white world. We were into that world, and it was white. It was the international celebrity world.
What the differences did that make in your life?
Well, I traveled a lot. I met a lot of fascinating people. I became probably more snobbish and more, I called myself a voyeur, which I was. I was fascinated by all these famous people. And I was sort of that kind of kid.
Your family spent a lot of time in Europe.
Yeah.
Was that for political and racial
reasons?
Yeah,
it was to avoid the blacklisting. And my mother was blacklisted from TV for a while. And so we were in Europe most of the 50s. I mean, every summer. You'd be in Europe.
You were sent to Quaker boarding school.
Yeah.
Did that change your social consciousness at all?
Well, it made me, I'd always gone to progressive schools. I'd always been brought up by progressive people, around progressive people. I was a little militant child in a way, lip service militant child. I knew what the issues were. And I certainly said, yes, I'm a pacifist. I probably didn't know why. Now I know why I'm a pacifist. Then I said, all right, I'm a pacifist. Pete Seeger was my hero. So, I mean, I was a... now I understand my politics. Then my politics were not in me. They were very much outer. They were a personality. Now my politics are ingested. And then they were simply sort of whatever was going. And I wasn't sincerely political because deep in my heart of hearts, I wanted to, go to Paris and wear French clothes and totally apolitical, basically.
You wrote that when your mother would show up at school with her minks and very high fashion clothes and makeup, which the other mothers didn't have,
yes,
that you were a little embarrassed by it.
I think we all go through a very conforming period at some point in adolescence, and that was during my adolescence in boarding school. I was a real conformist, and I did sort of not want to be different. Then I didn't want to be different at all.
Did you talk to her about that?
No.
She never knew that you were embarrassed? What did she say when she read it in the book?
She laughed.
Okay. During this period, she became very popular in nightclubs.
Yeah.
But you say that she really hated nightclubs.
Hated nightclubs.
Why?
Well, because usually they were run by the mob. And she considered most of her bosses to be very unsavory characters. She hated the audiences in Las Vegas. She hated everything about Las Vegas, but she made a lot of money. And in those days, Las Vegas was slightly, if you could call it, more elegant than it is now. I mean, it was really a mecca for huge stars. and there were only a few hotels, and you didn't get little old ladies getting off of buses. You got more sort of serious gambling people, and the money was enormous. It probably still is enormous, but probably much more so. But it was the place. It was, I mean, that's what you did. And she did hate it. She always said, I hate show business.
She was doing some TV then, too.
Yeah, she was doing a bit, but not a lot. No blacks had their own show when she wanted to have her shows.
Were there things that she couldn't do when performing with white people on TV?
You weren't meant to touch a white performer. A white performer wasn't meant to touch a black performer on television in the 50s. And Perry Como, there were certain people who always, Perry Como always took her arm or always put his arm around her. There were certain people who consciously flaunted the unwritten rule of no blacks and whites touching on television.
My guest is Gail Lumet Buckley, who's written a history of her family. It's called The Horns, an American Family. And her family includes Lena Horne, who is her mother. You went to Harvard. You went to Harvard, and your going to Harvard coincided with the Civil Rights Movement.
No, it didn't, actually.
Didn't you?
I graduated in 1959.
Oh, I thought you went a little later than
no,
that.
No. I graduated before there was the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, the pill, pot. We were prehistoric. We were the Eisenhower generation. When I was a senior, my roommate's fiancé, who is a wonderful white liberal. I hate the name to say white liberal because it sounds like they're not real, but he is one of the great true liberals. We have to make this word ring again with its true beauty and honesty and everything else. Said, let's go picket Woolworths. This was 1959. And I said, why are we picketing Woolworths? I mean, I knew they were picketing Woolworths in the South, but I didn't connect the Cambridge, Massachusetts Woolworth with the Southern Woolworth. I was really naive and silly, but there was no civil rights. There was nothing going on. So I went to you. I thought I was going to stay in Europe and live there.
When the civil rights movement...
Well, it was Kennedy that got me back. Mm-hmm. In 1960, I came home and immediately went out and campaigned for Kennedy and made speeches for him and voted for him, the first person I voted for. My entire class, the entire Harvard class, or the people I knew, I won't say the entire, but I mean a huge percentage, went to Washington. Then patriotism was not the last resort of whatever it is, scoundrels. You felt great. It was so great to be American when Kennedy was president. I mean, the same wonderful man who invited me to picket Woolworth joined the Peace Corps with my roommate, and they were in the first Peace Corps, and he wound up rewriting the tribal land laws of Nigeria. He had graduated the top of his class, the Harvard Law School as well. And then he was a Watergate counselor. Now he's chief counsel of the city of New York. So, I mean, he's a terrific guy, serious person. But they were, and so half of them went to the Justice Department, half of them went to the Peace Corps. I was going to go and work for the USIA, which is now called something else. What is the USIA now?
I'm trying to remember.
It was Edward R. Murrow was running it. It was the information.
United States Information Agency.
Yes. And now it's called something else. But anyway, I was going to work there, and then I got married instead. I was at Life, and I went down and was investigated by the FBI and everything. But I met Sidney and decided not to take that job.
Now, you write in your book that your mother did not want you to marry because he was...
A lot older, and he had three wives, or I would have been his third wife.
How serious a split was that between you and your mother over this marriage?
Not serious enough for her not to come to the wedding and be the mother of the bride and all that, which was not, it was a terrible wedding because it was the day after Kennedy was shot. So it was a nightmare of a wedding.
She had gotten married just as she'd started her career, and her husband, this is her first marriage.
Yes,
and
my father.
Yeah, and your father didn't want her to work in show business,
no.
And she kind of gave that up completely temporarily to be a housewife and mother, and was desperate to get back into performing, your father didn't want her to.
No, it was a showdown.
Was she worried that you were going to end up in that kind of situation, too, that although you weren't on the stage, that you'd end up in a marriage before you'd had a chance
She just felt I was going to be unhappily married. I think that was her feeling. She just felt, how could I be happy with a man who was so much older than I and who'd been married before? That was it, what it was. I think probably I'd feel the same thing on the surface if my daughter said, if my 21-year-old daughter, I was slightly older, said she was going to marry a 40-year-old man and she was going to be his third wife, I'd say, have you thought about this? I mean, it didn't actually matter. I stayed married for 14 years. That's a long time.
Yeah. You have two children?
Yes.
So you were pregnant and bringing up your children during some pretty dramatic changes
yes,
in America.
Yes, absolutely. 1964, I had my first child. 1967, I had my second child.
So during some of the civil rights movement, during a lot of musical changes, you write about how you're going to go to a Beatles concert
yes.
the first time they came, but
yes.
you couldn't because you were too pregnant.
I was too pregnant. And that was sort of my 60s. I felt, oh, God, I never had a 60s. And I sort of had my 60s like in the 70s or something, in the 80s, because I really felt I was on the sidelines. I was a very conscientious mother, and I was devoted to Dr. Spock. And somewhere I knew people were marching and trying drugs and whatever they were doing, and I wasn't doing any of it. I was listening to Puff the Magic Dragon and, you know, taking the children to the park. A lot of mothers... Probably if my husband had been younger, if I'd been married to a man my own age, we might have been, because we might have taken the children along, you know, it would have been as people would have done my age, couples of my age would have done. But Sydney was very, I was a late 50s person and Sydney was definitely a late 30s person.
What kind of racial sense did your children grow up with?
My children are very funny because they both claim that their strongest racial identity is Jewish, which is their father. And their father is not a religious Jew at all. He's culturally a Jewish person. So it's not even religious. Though I must say, after they read the book, they both sort of jokingly said, oh, if we'd known we were American Indian, we might have been more interested in that, you know, aspect of their lives. They seem to feel that, that the black battles have been won, except in South Africa. They seem to have this feeling, and they seem to feel that the Jewish battles have not been won yet. I don't think any of the battles have been won. I think they're so interconnected you can't separate them, because bigotry is bigotry, whether it's against Asians, blacks, or Jews, or whatever.
One of the things that's happened to you in the past few years is that you had a religious awakening.
Yes, a reawakening, I would say. I was a Catholic child. My mother had been a Catholic child. She'd brought me up as a Catholic child. I got away from it for years until I grew up. And partly because, certainly I would not be a Catholic today if it were not for Vatican II and John the 23rd. And I came to it by way of the East, which is curious, because somebody gave me a book by Krishnamurti. That was having my 60s, I suppose, in the 70s. And I discovered there was something happened. And I went all through the East and came back and reread the New Testament and said, wait a minute, I'm a Westerner and this is what I am. And I feel, I don't want to say born again Christian because I think the bad people have taken over that. It's like the bad people, it's like giving liberals a bad name. They're giving Christians a bad name. And Christ was a wonderful person who loved poor people, didn't believe in nuking the poor. Or I don't go along with the sexual politics of the church, but I think in terms of social justice, I think the Catholic bishops are so far ahead of the politicians in this country that it's a joke almost.
So has that... newly...
It's repoliticized me as well as re-religiousized me. It has colored my politics. I mean, I believe in the sanctuary movement. I am firmly against... Now I know why I'm a pacifist. I'm certainly against our Nicaragua policy on religious as well as political grounds. I am, I suppose, a Catholic out of the Barragan tradition. I haven't thrown any blood on nuclear submarines, and I don't know if I will, but if I would be prepared to, there would be issues which would take me to the streets, certainly South African issues and certainly social justice issues that would awaken, would come from my Catholic conscience, absolutely.
So the religion, in a way, has given a shape to certain incoherent
feelings
that you had before.
Yes, it's absolutely, it's made me a new person, a person who I like a lot better than the other person, a person who's sort of together.
So you've really been changed a lot through the religion and through writing the book, which put you in touch with your history and your sense of being Black and American in a way that you never felt before.
My roots.
What did the book do for your mother, do you think?
How did she perceive it? She's very happy with it. She's very proud of me. And she discovered new things about her family. And I think she feels very happy. She feels, I don't know whether it's a, she feels that it's given her a kind of sense of roots, too, that she sort of knew vaguely a lot of this. But now it's a real, it's a good feeling.
It places her in a social and historical context that she might have not have,
no,
I guess, felt.
No, exactly. No, she didn't feel it, especially having felt, having had this really sad childhood, being torn between her two sets of relations and feeling like an orphan. And this has given her a sense of belonging.
And for your daughters reading the book?
Yes. I mean, they're much the cooler about it. I mean, they are the Eddie Murphy generation. And the Archie Bunker, you know, they're post-Archie Bunker. They're 70s kids, Free to Be You and Me. They are liberated to a degree that my mother and I will never be. Certainly my mother will never be. Or maybe she will be in some grander way. But they like it. They think I'm a good writer, which made me happy. They loved the story. They were sort of surprised. Mom, it's really good. Gee, we really like the book. One of my daughters wants to be a writer, so that's good. And the other wants to make films, maybe. So they're a funny combination of feminists, yuppies in a way, even though they claim that they despise that, but they're very interested in money. They're not interested in politics. They're tuned out of politics, turned off by what they consider sleaze factor. They sort of like the idea that there was a Kennedy, and they like the idea that, you know, they're sort of, if there could be such a thing as calling themselves Kennedy Democrats, they would call themselves Kennedy Democrats. My older daughter voted for Mondale for her first, voting for really for Geraldine Ferraro, she maintained the time. And they're very modern kids. I don't consider myself modern.
Your mother, when she got married, made sure to keep Horn in her name. So she used that as her, she continued to use that name as her stage name, and then used hyphenated names for her private life. But Horn was always in it, and Horn really meant something.
In
New York.
Yes.
You never really had Horn.
My name. I had it once. Gail Horn Jones was the name I was christened or baptized, Gail Horn Jones.
Has writing the book made you want to, like, stick it back in
somehow? No, because I signed the book contract as Lumette, and then I married Kevin Buckley, and I wanted Buckley to be in there. So it was a funny, there was no way to be Gail Horn, because it wasn't really my name. I mean, it would be Gail Horn Jones Lumette Buckley. That's too many, unless I did sort of G8. There's an MKP Fisher or whatever her name is. So it was difficult.
What reaction has your husband had to the book?
He loves the book. He's very proud of me and very happy.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your family.
I loved doing it. It was fun.
Thanks for being
here. You're a wonderful interviewer.
Thank you. My guest has been Gail Lumette Buckley, and she's written a family history. It's called The Horns, An American Family, and it traces her family back to the Civil War through being in the North and through her mother's career on stage and screen and through her life as a mother and now writer. And the book, The Horns, An American Family, is published by Knopf. And thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 5 minutes to 5. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I think we can get in a couple of minutes of Lena Horne as recorded from her recent one-woman show. And this is her recording.
Said I many times, Love is illusion, a feeling result of confusion, with knowing smile and blasé sigh, a cynical so and so. I felt so sure, so positive, so utterly unchangingly certain that I never was aware of love and you till suddenly I realized there was love and you and I in this world. Ordinary people, extraordinary people, I'm glad there is you in this world of overrated pleasures, of underrated treasures, I'm glad.
An excerpt of Lena Horne singing I'm Glad There Is You. 3.5 minutes to 5 is the time, all things considered, coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you about tomorrow's fresh air after we check in with shadow traffic.
Heading west on 76, slow from south to Vine, then again between Montgomery and Belmont. That's a 25-minute delay. Jammed once more from Gulf Mills at the approach of Route 202, a car fire blocking the right-hand lane. Traveling eastbound, slow from Gulf Mills to the Blue Route, then jammed between Broad and the Whitman Tolls, 42 south, slow from 130 to 295. 95 northbound, that's jammed, a 25-minute delay from the Penn's Landing area all the way up to the Ben Franklin Bridge, slow again approaching Woodhaven Road. That's shadow traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That shadow traffic report was funded by the Albert Einstein Medical Center. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by novelist Ellen Curry. This Sunday at 6 on The Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be playwright and actor Wallace Shawn, who co-wrote and co-starred in the film My Dinner with Andre, and we'll talk about theater and movies, so I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Ron Barron was the engineer this afternoon, along with Audrey Voblaitis. Fresh Air's associate producer is Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts invites you to visit this summer. Located at the corner of Broad and Cherry Streets in Philadelphia, the Academy is the home of an exciting collection of American art spanning three centuries. The collection features outstanding works by Charles Wilson Peale, Thomas Aikens, Winslow Homer, and Georgia O'Keeffe. This summer, the Academy is the only East Coast stop for the critically acclaimed retrospective Franz Klein, The Vital Gesture. Robert Hughes, Time Magazine's art critic, characterized this show as distinguished and commanding. The Philadelphia Inquirer said it was a splendid opportunity to delve into the mysteries of abstraction. Come and see for yourself why New York Times critic Michael Brenson called Klein's images the richest in all of abstract painting. Franz Klein, The Vital Gesture, at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, now through September 28th. For information, call 215-972-7600. You're listening to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
The world learn only very few part of Thai women, and they get that image that all of us are prostitutes. Come, yeah? That is not right.
Rangsima is educated, middle class, and a feminist, a new kind of woman in Thailand. Tonight on All Things Considered, Thai women fighting the image of sexual submissiveness.
Also, President Reagan urged to speak out on South Africa.
Full disclosure, the Mies Commission releases its 1,500-page report on pornography.
Cocaine laced with cyanide, at least one death, several ill in the Salt Lake City region.
Baby peregrine falcons to be released in downtown Minneapolis.
And the highest pole vault ever in Moscow.
That and more, and this news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. In Paris today, a bomb exploded at police headquarters, killing one officer and injuring 20 others. Melody Walker reports.
The police headquarters building, the scene of today's explosion, is located in the center of Paris, just two blocks from City Hall and across the river from Notre Dame Cathedral. The 22-pound bomb, placed in a restroom on the fifth floor of the building, shattered windows and caused heavy damage to the offices of the anti-crime unit. The administrative offices are normally open to the public, and police say...